This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com.
Hello and welcome to the Testing Show. I'm your host, Matt Heuser. Today we are live, well, we are recording from the Conference for the Association for Software Testing with a quorum of our regular guests. So we also have Justin Rohrman.
Hi there.
You know Justin from the show, but you might not know he's the president of the Association for Software Testing.
I'm president as of today. Tomorrow we'll see. we're having our annual elections, so.
And which also means he's been kind of busy with the conference.
I've been very busy.
He wore a sport coat.
Oh,
and
yes,
fancy
he did.
Shoes.
I have to admit, this is the first time in my life I've owned a sport coat.
Looks all right. So. And of course, we have Brzee Ababa.
Hi, everyone.
All the way from New Jersey.
Yes, that's correct.
But
beautiful Princeton, New Jersey. Yes.
But he's here. We're in the same room. We also have a very special guest today, Michael Bolton, the principal consultant at DevelopSense.
The only consultant at DevelopSense.
I've known Michael a long time. He came to Grand Rapids, Michigan 10, 12 years ago. He spoke at the Grand Rapids Programming Users Group. We've worked together on a few things since. So welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you.
And you did a tutorial yesterday on test opsies.
Yes.
What's a test opsie?
A test opsie is a dissection of a session of testing. And one of the things that we discovered yesterday is that actually we could apply that kind of analysis, sort of thing that Rob Sabaran likes to talk about, for instance, a task analysis of what's going on during a testing session. And so with the group, we collected things to look for, things to observe, ongoing processes, moments, skills, tactics, activities, and catalog those and apply them to a couple of sessions of testing. It was a lot of fun for me, and I learned a lot myself, and I think people there did too.
So test opsies to me sounds like a way to begin an anthropology experiment to some degree, because you're collecting massive amounts of this qualitative data about how people actually do testing, and then you can pick it apart and find patterns in it to some degree.
Absolutely. Although I don't want to overstate my skills as an anthropologist, I'm a tyro when it comes to that sort of stuff. But that's the general principle, yes.
Is that the intention with developing test opsie, or is it more of a teaching aid?
It's both, of course. We're trying to understand the activities that are going on so that we can analyze them and discuss them, improve them. The idea is to do something and to study it and to see where it can be done again with intentionality. One of the things that is kind of interesting as part of the process is trying to figure out how to name certain things so that we can talk about them, so we have a handle to grab onto them when we discuss them.
What are examples of some of the things you're trying to name?
Some of the names exist already, of course, in the discourse. One example is factoring, identifying things that might matter to a test condition or to something that's happening in the product. It's also called a variable analysis sometimes, but it's not just about variables necessarily. It might be trying to break down a function or a feature into things that are happening, things that aren't happening.
Okay, so it makes sense to call it factoring then instead of variable, so you're overloading the term just a little bit less.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We're trying to go deeper on each one of those things. Recording as we're testing. What happens is we record something. To break that down, we notice it, we become aware of it, we put it in the forefront of our consciousness. We edit, we narrate, we justify as we're doing testing work in general, and as we're doing something as simple as writing a note. Managing tempo, pace of what we're doing. So one of the things that came up yesterday was the notion of the role of pauses in testing work, giving the opportunity for our critical thinking faculties to wake up. One of the things that came up in today's keynote, for example, is when we're engaged in a task, I thought it was an amazing thing. It had never occurred to me, and of course, in retrospect, it's completely obvious. When Nicholas Carr was talking this morning during the open season, one of the things he pointed out is that we have very little space in our short-term memory. It's like we don't have that many registers available to us. And so one of the things that can easily get displaced from working memory is the goal of the task that we're engaged in. In retrospect, well, that sounds completely obvious, but it had not occurred to me quite that dramatically before he said so. We looked a little bit at the value of note-taking in testing as a means of deliberately introducing pauses into the tempo of your work, which gives you just a little moment to start asking the critical thinking kinds of questions. Am I still on mission? is what I'm seeing really what it looks like? What am I noticing? What might I be missing? Well, I believe pretty strongly that when I watch people who are managing the tempo of their note-taking, it affords that opportunity to look at what they're doing just a little more reflectively than they might otherwise.
That's an interesting idea. I've heard that referred to as slack time before, adding space into the work so you have time to reflect.
I think that's true. However, slack time is often thought of in a larger sense, adding to the schedule. I was interested yesterday in the micro sense of adding that kind of slack. Right?
Like adding pauses in the actual flow of testing work, hands off the keyboard to a notepad.
Or to even to another screen where you're picking notes or building a mind map or something like that. So there's a great big long list that has developed over the years. I mean, it used to be part of a list that originated with James and John Bach called Exploratory Skills and Tactics. But then we started to realize if testing is fundamentally an exploratory activity, and I believe it really is, then that list should be generalized into just general skills and tactics. So managing focus, managing tempo, moments of collaboration, interviewing, questioning, modeling, comparing, conjecturing, all these things are happening all the time as we're testing. And it's interesting to look at them at varying levels of granularity. James did a session of 7 minutes of testing with Alexander Simic, recorded it, and then looked at what was happening in 2 second increments.
Mm-hmm.
Went over the game film and looked at it. Another thing that we've done, and this has been around for a little while, is looking at an entire testing session or a tester's day or a tester's week in anything from 2 to 10 minute chunks and trying to find out what the dominating activity is in each one of those things. One of the things that we realized via thought experiment, it turns out whenever we've collected actual data, it's a good deal worse than this. But via thought experiment, we looked at a plausible week's worth of testing. We broke it down into 10-minute increments, things that might happen, you know, chats with the developer and chats with coworkers, sometimes on mission, sometimes off mission. Test design and execution, whereupon we obtain coverage. Bug investigation and reporting, setup, lunch, coffee breaks, new builds. Well, we looked at that, and in a thought experiment that we ran in our heads, when we broke it all down, laid it out, we realized that 1 week's worth of testing work might easily be as little as 1 day's worth of coverage. And we keep showing this to people. And they say, oh, yeah, that looks like my week, except it looks a little optimistic.
Mm. When you say coverage, you mean actual software testing.
Learn forward testing progress.
Well, we got to be careful about actual testing, because it's all testing work.
It is all testing.
So what we're trying to do is I think you used the word overload, recognize that the word testing is overloaded, and try to look at those activities at a finer level of granularity. One of the things that we notice right away is that testers actually spend a relatively small amount of time learning about the product, actively engaged in interacting with the product and learning about it and increasing test coverage. Another insight was, again, something that in retrospect is kind of obvious, but until you notice it, it's lurking there below the surface. The bugs that we find are by definition the shallowest bugs mm-hmm. in the product. When we looked with a client where I did some of this on-site work, what I found was a tester who essentially spent an entire afternoon getting ready to test, preparing to test, doing setup work, trying to get the machinery connected, trying to get the test environment up and running, recognizing, oh, there's another problem and it's off to the server room. Each walk to the server room took 3 minutes or so. And she had to take 11 trips to the server room in one afternoon of testing. So to the manager, who's not looking very carefully, that's 4 hours worth of testing work. But if you look a little more closely, there is actually half an hour of that 4 hours walking. Which allows us, of course, to ask some questions about that and say, well, might it be a good idea to situate the testers closer to the server room? Might it be a good idea for there to be somebody in the server room with whom the tester could interact and connect? This particular kind of work required physical plugging of machinery and so on and so forth. When we look at things in detail, we get to find out all these little ways that we could have of optimizing things.
So in lean software testing, we call the walking back and forth transportation waste. When we talk about, and we can, you know, some other time argue about the meaning of the word waste, but
Yeah, well, yeah, for instance.
It's heuristic.
It is
not
heuristic.
Waste for everyone.
Right, it's heuristic. Or we talk about touch time, which
mm-hmm.
is by hands-on keyboard productive work
mm-hmm.
versus waiting for a build or waiting for a server to be provisioned or waiting for a decision or, well, I sent the email, so till the product owner tells me what he wants, I can't file the bug or not, so I'm blocked. I think that's all kind of swirling in some of the same waters.
I was in Michael's session yesterday. I was in a group with Neil Studd, Stephen Woody, and Amit Wertheimer, and we came up with a mnemonic.
Well, yes.
For the things that you can observe what a tester is doing. So we call it the Christmas mnemonic. C stands for conversation and collaboration. You see people talking, as Michael was talking about earlier. There's a time where you apply heuristics or discover new heuristics. We're also recording results and note-taking. I is for interacting with the product. S is for speculation and thinking through your hypotheses. T is for tool usage. M is for modeling and refining that same model. A is articulating assumptions. And S is setup, configuration, and orientation. Just a small subset of what the list was.
I was totally thrilled by that. And the reason I'm totally thrilled by it is because it's an instance of something that James and I keep talking about in our work. How important it is for people to invent testing for themselves. Now, these are four really skilled people. So I'm not at all surprised that this came out on one level. And yet it was so wonderful to see that little mnemonic getting developed there. It was terrific. And that's the kind of thing that spending a day on looking at things on a kind of micro level like this, it affords that opportunity, and so it was terrific. That was one of the great moments of yesterday for me.
Thank you.
I used to struggle with mnemonics. I didn't get a ton out of them, but then when you start to make up your own, they become real for you.
You got to own them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That's such a huge difference. And you can get a lot of value out of Kopfungun or San Francisco Depot, or there's lots of value there. But when you start to make it up for yourself, you own the process. You take personal responsibility for your work. That's when I think the magic starts to happen.
There was a moment as well yesterday when we looked at what happens when we get work invalidated by new information and by new stuff. The degree to which sometimes as testers we really do have to backtrack and do sanity checking of revised builds and so on and so forth. That is part of the cost of doing business in a sense, but it also affords the opportunity for even more learning and more recognition of what's going on in the product. I'm suddenly reminded of Jerry Weinberg's observation that it's not waste if you're learning something, if something happens. With the transportation waste example, Matt, that you gave, my ex was a manager of configuration and builds, also responsible for internationalization back in the day at Quarterdeck. She had a really interesting strategy. She set up her printer. She had a corner office. She set up her default printer to be on the opposite side of the office. Now, that sounds initially crazy. Why would you do that? The answer was it afforded her the mandate to walk to the other corner of the building and encounter people all the way through it, because, of course, it's a rectangular building. You have the option of going through on a sort of diagonal path or around the edges or some combination of the two. That took her past, by one route, the reception and CEO's office and the sales office and the marketing people. And then by the other route, you'd go past testers and programmers and that sort of stuff. So whenever she printed something, she deliberately introduced, on the surface of it, would look wasteful, but actually turns out to be this incredibly valuable social thing.
That is ridiculously clever.
There's a little bit of genius right there. For the same reason, or a similar kind of reason anyway, I almost took up smoking back in those days. Yeah, didn't. It makes me throw up. Then I realized, oh, you can hang out with the people who are smoking and just drink coffee.
That was in the era of programmers survive on coffee and nicotine, right?
Did that change ever? I don't remember that changing. In any case, when we look at stuff in a one-week length kind of test opsy is a name for what is probably in anthropology known as task analysis, ethnography, I suppose. When we look at what people are actually doing, we see an immense amount of stuff that looks like waste but is actually very important socially.
Yeah, I want to add to that because that is a real risk in that the sort of prescriptive listing of the wastes and then going after them is like the bottom of the hierarchy. So we teach that flow trumps removal of waste. You may build a buffer on purpose in front of a state that you want to keep busy, and that will actually improve flow, and that value for customer trumps them both. And even those are heuristic.
When you're speaking of efficiency there, I think we get messed up about that sometimes. And it flows directly from Nicholas Carr's keynote this morning. The observation that Toyota made, realizing that efficiency is not the same thing as effectiveness. The assembly line and robots and stuff that they've been using are terrific if you want to get out a large number of products all at the same time, but then that takes a hit on the human capacity to observe and to refine the designs of things and to notice problems in the designs of things and so forth. I think that's directly transportable to the world of software development as well. We see things that are frightfully efficient, but they don't necessarily allow us to maintain engagement with what we're actually doing. So there were a lot of really terrific notes in his talk on that particular topic with everything we do, and not just with automation, but with every activity that we do or that we name or that we engage in. We lose some things on the swings that we gain on the roundabouts. And it's important for us to observe those and study them, recognize them for what they are.
So let's talk about three of them. Substitution fallacy, automation complacency, and automation bias. And if we have time, we can cover alert fatigue. I thought it was impressive he gave a label to things that we have all observed and had very hard conversations about. Substitution fallacy, the idea that we can just plug in automation into a process that a human used to do and nothing else will be changed and they'll do it exactly the same.
So it's certainly not new. McLuhan at one point said we shape our tools there after they shape us. But before him, I don't remember, Jerry Weinberg told me it was Emerson or Thoreau said
yes,
that
Elliot.
We have become our tools. That's been true ever since we picked up a stick. The stick changes us. It extends us. It enhances us. It enables us to do things. It also obsolesces other things that might have been important. It reverses into the opposite of what it was originally intended to do if we overuse it. Those are three of McLuhan's four laws of media. I love the idea that it doesn't replace the work, it changes the work in various interesting ways. That reminded me very strongly of Harry Collins's abstract for Eurostar 2013, the talk he never gave, in which he said that computers and their software are two things. He said, as machinery, interacting cogs, they have to be checked to make sure that the teeth spin together and that the wheels spin nicely. But then he also points out that machines are also social prostheses fitting into human life where a human once fitted. I would add to that, or where a human with superpowers could fit, even if a human had never actually been there before. But it's a characteristic of medical prostheses, he says, like artificial hearts, that they don't exactly replace the thing that they were designed to replace. The surrounding body has to compensate. He says contemporary computers can't do the things that humans do because they were not brought up as social agents. They don't participate in society. They're not socialized. Therefore, we need a complex social judgment in order to determine whether humans will happily repair the difference between what the machine does and the person that it replaces. And he says that's far more than a matter of making sure whether the cogs spin right. So it's nice to have that handle, that substitution fallacy. The hook to hang that idea on is nice.
Well, the one insight that I thought was really good, the human tendency to have automation, to trust it, turn your brain off, leads to
right.
two situations. It leads to complacency, where you're just not even looking out the window anymore as a pilot on autopilot. Then when something goes wrong and the alarms start going off, it's not doing what you expected. It injects a humongous amount of stress because you haven't been really flying so much. So you actually have had skill atrophy, and you're injected in a situation of high stress.
I think it goes as far as like questioning a notion of authority. So whether that is a person or an automaton or an API result, it's personally for me, from the culture that I grew up in, it's not very easy to question authority. I come from the Philippines. There's the hierarchy of elders where you pay respect to them, and when they say something, that goes. It gets a bit difficult to translate that into the workforce because that ends up emanating from that. And then when I came to the United States, that was something that I really struggled with because I was encouraged to question things. Just because your boss is screaming at you doesn't mean he's mad at you. He's mad at something that you can counteract to that.
I'm kind of the other side of that because I went to like this hippy-dippy question everything school. And when I got into business, it was Matt needs to work on his social skills. And what does that mean? And I read all the books.
I read How to Win Friends and Influence People and the 7 Habits of Highly Effective, and I read everything. And really, it was, I was just supposed to say yes in the meeting where I knew the factual answer was no. You can't people skill your ways out of it. I mean, you can try. There's a definite, like, we're both being pushed toward the middle.
Well, there's one way we have of getting around that issue sometimes. We apply safety language to that. Can you log in at the moment? I have not been able to log in. Just expressing things in terms of a precise expression can often be helpful. Not always, of course. Nobody really likes bad news.
Certainly we talk about techniques to wiggle on the hook, but when what they want you to say is yes, and the answer is not yes, it can be problematic.
This was a great Jerry Weinberg lesson. It's fine for people to want things. It's okay. No, they can want things. I've often said this. I want to play in the NBA. Trouble is, I'm a week away from my 55th birthday. I'm not in terribly good shape. I'm healthy, but also I'm 5'7". I have no discernible skills in basketball. Don't even actually really like the game. Come to think of it, I don't want to be in the NBA. I just want the money. Well, then, of course, it's okay for me to want the money, but I'm not likely to get it. And so that's just reality. So it's okay for people to want stuff. It's not okay to assume that they're going to be able to get it. And if you recognize that they want something, if you acknowledge that, it's okay to respond to that desire and to say, well, I get that you'd like to know that it's working. I'm afraid I've got some bad news based on my observation anyway. Mm. For the moment, all situations are temporary. That's the other thing, right? Well, I can't log in right now. That can soften the blow a little bit.
So Carr's solution to this automation tends to either make us complacent, the plane is crashing and the alarms are going off, is to turn the automation off, if I understood him correctly, is to turn the automation off every now and again, keep running it by hand so our skills don't atrophy, is one of the things he recommended. How would that apply for the way most companies build software today?
It really does come down to that for me. Let us remember that we are developing software to accomplish human purposes. Let us engage in those human purposes every now and again, specifically because it's far more than a matter of making sure that the wheels spin right. The funny thing about that to me is software is very deterministic. It'll do the same thing over and over again, and what we seem to be doing in many places, certainly many of the clients I've been to, seem not to be engaging with the goal of checking the software, which is to learn surprising new facts about it, right? That's why we test. We learn stuff about the product that other people haven't noticed before. That's one of the reasons that I am excited about the use of tools, about the use of automation as an exploratory device. And that is, of course, is by no means a new idea. Cam Kaner's been talking about that for years. Brian Merrick, I think, brought it up in, I think it was the late 90s. In 1998 or so, he wrote a super paper on the principle that one of the things that we might choose to do is to make our products testable in a way that makes them friendlier, more amenable to exploration, aided by tools. I think it's a terrific thing to do. So much of the checking that is being done right now, I think really could be done at the developer level and should be done at the developer level because it's developer-oriented risk. It's the kinds of risks that developers are, in fact, very good at finding. So let's do that. As testers, we can certainly assist with that process. But the other way we can assist with it, which I think might be incredibly powerful, is by using some of the test ops-like stuff, the examination of how testers actually use their time, to ask, well, wait a second, are some of these bugs that the testers are finding low-hanging fruit in developer space? Because it takes far longer to investigate and report a bug after you've performed a test right. than it does to perform the test in lots of cases, especially for those low-level, very highly functional, rather than parafunctional, coding error-ish kinds of bugs. Let's point out that finding those things represents a loss of coverage for the organization. Because every moment that we spend investigating and reporting a bug, by and large, is another moment that we're not spending on extending and deepening and broadening our test coverage. That means that testers can help developers make the case for something that a lot of developers seem to be calling out for, which is a little bit more time to produce stuff that is quite a bit better. That was a big point in the development of XP.
Yeah, our term for that is first-time quality. In that if the first-time quality is low, you end up spending a lot of time in these fine-fixed retest loops. That, then your touch time is going to be low because you're waiting for a new build.
That sort of stuff reminds me of the minimum viable product thing. The emphasis appears to be on minimum and not so much on viable.
Right,
that's a good point. It's a funny phrase.
I know, by the way, that I've received the minimum viable product lots of times. But yeah, let's emphasize viable and not so much minimum. I'd like to see a little bit more of that. We're all in this business to get stuff done and to get stuff done quickly. I think it might be important to see how we trip ourselves up in that effort. Make little changes, little things that would allow us to do things in a way that you can't necessarily say that any particular activity, setup, bug investigation, and reporting is wasteful. But if we look at it a little bit more closely, we can see opportunities maybe for tuning it or for changing it in little ways that provide us with some big benefits.
All right. Well, I think I've used enough of your time. Thanks for the half hour, Michael. Anything you want to talk about, conferences you're going to be speaking at?
I'll be at Star West and I'll be at Eurostar in the fall and lots of other work around the world.
And they can find more about you at DevelopSense.com.
People can find me, Michael, at DevelopSense.com. I'm happy to hear from people. Really, we get such immense value out of people contacting us and asking us questions or contributing experience reports and that sort of stuff. It's great to hear from people in the community. So keep those cards and letters coming, kids.
And you can email the testing show at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com. I'm going to give Percy the last word.
All right. So in October, in Philadelphia, Test Bash is coming. It's a good time to be a tester in the Northeast. And of course, as a fellow organizer of the NYC Testers Meetup Group, we do have our monthly meetups. So just look out for those.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.